Good evening, everybody, and welcome to our Halloween episode of Pod Stallions. I am Brian, and way out in the smoky mists of California, I have Jason.
Hi, Brian.
And we are going to spend this Halloween talking about the director of Halloween, John Carpenter. We're going to go through his career. Now, I can't speak for Jason, but I think we may have a similar experience in that we were both Starlog kids, and you started to get to know names when you were a Starlog kid, and there were certain names that became synonymous with, you know, cool stuff going on, and those names would be like, well, Gene Roddenberry, Gerry Anderson, George Romero, Tom Savini. And for me, I remember the first time I ever encountered anything about John Carpenter and consistently encountered about John Carpenter was in the pages of Starlog. Would you agree with that, Jason?
Absolutely. In fact, when I think of, and forgive me, listeners, my voice is a little off. Hope you can hear me okay.
It's going to be a Brian-heavy episode.
Yeah, Brian-heavy. I'm the guy on the show. The show's become so popular now that one of the leads, like, got a movie deal, and he's off making a movie, so they only have him, like, in two scenes in an office, and then this is kind of a Brian-heavy episode where he's, you know,
And then next week, Jason will be replaced by Belle LeBeau. Was that the guy's name on Welcome Back, Cotter?
Yes. And then next season, we're going to bring in a robot of some kind. Just a sidekick.
And a kid.
To bring drinks and stuff like that on our boat. So, I would agree with that. In fact, I think of that in terms of those year-end issues where they do the thank yous. You know, thank you, Starlog. It's your fifth anniversary, and if not for you. I mean, that's how I kind of understood who Gerry Anderson was or what he looked like. You know, Forry Ackerman, I knew who he was. But, I mean, those year-end things, and those black-and-white shots of Carpenter with big tash, and that black, you know, shoulder-length hair.
Yeah.
He sort of became this character that I wouldn't have seen or heard speak at that point.
No. Nope.
But we absolutely knew who these guys were because of Starlog. I would absolutely agree with every bit of that. Absolutely.
And Starlog would sell, like, his soundtracks in the back, so you like he had a monthly presence in Starlog, and I knew what Dark Star was. I only saw Dark Star like a couple years ago, but I knew what it was when I saw it at the video store. It's like, that's Carpenter's first film, and he did it with Dan O'Bannon, you know. Just because I was, you know, a little sponge for this information back then.
Well, that's a funny thing right there, and we'll get more in detail when you take over the show. That's a fascinating little thing. I mean, I don't know when I started to tie the tapestry together of Dan O'Bannon, John Carpenter, and Alien, Dark Star and Alien, and the connection of O'Bannon.
Yeah.
And how they were all in the same kind of atmosphere.
And how that Jordanowski's Dune was somehow a catalyst for Alien as well, right? Because didn't O'Bannon write it after that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was many years later, but the fact that O'Bannon and Carpenter both kind of kicked off together, and then one goes off and makes this massive Halloween movie that, you know, costs nothing, and the other one goes off and does, you know, Alien. It's like, it's extraordinary, these guys. But let's go. Tell us about the childhood of John Carpenter, Brian, while I go solve a crime off camera.
I don't know anything about John Carpenter's childhood.
John Carpenter was born with shoulder-length hair.
And a mustache.
Yeah.
No, I know very little actually about his personal life, other than he was married to Adrienne Barbeau at one time.
And we love him for it.
Yes.
Let's just say that. We absolutely love him. Well, he was married to Deborah Hill, who was the producing partner on
Halloween. Yeah.
And I don't know, forgive me, I don't know enough about her, and it's sad that I don't, but I have looked her up to see her sort of body of work. I don't know if she was a producer on Assault on Precinct 13 or Darkstar or any of that stuff, but she is the... She is the sort of unsung brilliance of Halloween.
Oh, I agree.
And those early Carpenters that doesn't get nearly the credit, I don't think, that she deserves. And they were they became like kind of a power couple because of Halloween. I know that he, I don't know much about his childhood or his young life. I know he's a big movie guy, big horror guy. I happen to know he's not a fan of Val Lewton. Of the Val Lewton pictures, the director, like Cat People and things like that. He is, he's been vocal about thinking that he's kind of smoke and mirrors. It's not that great. But I think he's a big Hitchcock fan, a big horror fan. You know, he's one of us, I think. That's what I always gathered, that he was a big geek and loved all this stuff. And then, you know,
it's kind of weird. I didn't really ever, like, how do I put this? I discovered, you ever like you realize, hey, I like 12 songs by this band. I should just buy all their albums. You know what I mean? Like,
I think
it was the band Cracker. I was talking to my wife, and like, she's like, you love Cracker. Why don't you own any of their LPs? And it's like, I don't know. And I felt the same way about Carpenter. As when I look at the body of his work, I would have trouble picking my three favorites. Because I'd have to kick something out of the bed I like. And
let me answer this two ways. First, by saying my band in that example would be Wilson Phillips.
Oh,
same thing.
Yeah.
I'm suddenly driving around going, I'm singing to a lot of their songs, but I don't have any of their stuff.
Yeah.
What's the problem? But yes, in fact, I was thinking about this before the show. He I would say, and we're jumping ahead, but I would say, honestly, I would say up to Prince of Darkness, which I think is very underrated, maybe even In the Mouth of Madness, which I don't remember if that's an adaptation of something, I forget.
Nope.
His track record was quality-wise, you know, pound for pound, he was just kind of unstoppable. You know, even when he tripped a bit, I love it, The Fog, you know, stuff like that. It wasn't as big, but he had an incredible track record when you line all of them up.
But when I turned 18 that I saw every single film he made in the theater after that.
I was just
looking at it. It's like, saw that in the theater, saw that in the theater, saw that. It's like, oh yeah, if it said Carpenter, I went. And
so what would have been the first, so you think you would have seen him in Starlog and been aware of him in Starlog before you saw Halloween?
I didn't see Halloween right away. I don't, I have a personal issue against slasher films, and it's just my personal issue. There's some trauma in my family, and I don't derive entertainment from that. So I purposely avoid it. I don't like Freddy and Jason and all that because of it. But so I avoided Halloween for years, thinking, well, I don't really care. And that was such a huge misnomer because it's actually an amazing film. It's an actual fantastic movie, but I think my first Carpenter film would have probably been The Thing, or possibly, okay. No, it would have been The Thing or Escape from New York. I can't remember, but those would have been my first Carpenter experiences. And then, you know, I got into all the others.
Well, our ages are similar. Yeah. I did not see Halloween in the theater. I was a kid,
yeah.
It loomed large. Like, it was something that I just knew wasn't positive what it was about, but it was like a constant, you know, that was around. I think I showed you this once. I should photograph this and send you this to post. I found, sometimes I'd be at my dad's office. Like, if I'd get dropped off there when I was, you know, 9, 10 or whatever, and he'd be doing stuff, and I would find these little pads of paper and I would, you know, draw. And I found this little kind of, not a flip book, but like this little packet of papers that were stapled together, where I was drawing. I had clearly either seen movie posters or the trailers for these movies.
Yeah.
And was drawing like it's coming, you know, coming this Christmas or, you know, da, 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 da. And in this little thing, I drew the black hole, Star Trek, the motion picture, the fog, and I forget what else, but my fog drawing is a hand coming up out of the fog or the water.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, the fog. So, I mean, so I would have been like 10. So I didn't see the fog in the theater, but I knew what it was, and I knew that I wanted to see it. I did not see Escape from New York. I saw The Thing in the theater, and it you know, scared the crap out of me.
How the hell? You got into the theater? Wow.
Well, my cousin David, who I told you, he's a criminal, and he's an absolute criminal, you know. We got into that, and I don't know if I stayed for the whole, I forget. Maybe it was fairly traumatic, and it was, again, that sort of, your heart's racing about like you shouldn't be in the theater because you're younger or whatever. But after that, it was a staple of VHS rental. Like he would rent that movie, twice a month, and we would watch it to death. Which then, of course, led to renting Escape from New York and, you know, whatever else. And so those were on a loop, and that's where I started to catch up with Carpenter's stuff and kind of put it together. That he always struck me as this guy that was like, you know, it was, when you think about his stuff, he's a genre thriller kind of guy. He's not the king of horror or something, or the king of the macabre.
No, he's directed a ton of science fiction too.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. So he had. You know, he dipped his toe in sci-fi and in pulp stuff and in, full-on horror, thriller, you know, like he was all around when it comes to the genre stuff, I think.
Yeah, he's well-rounded in that regard. He does make, you know, fantastical films, but it's not one thing, and he's definitely not pigeonholed into horror. I'm just trying to think, going back and forth, I think, Halloween 3 may have been one of my first Carpenter movies as well. And I know that he didn't actually, he's just producer on that, but
his, I don't know how much you know about that, but my, from what I understand, and I'm sure people will, you know, confirm this, when we get letters that we get every month, he didn't want anything to do with Michael Myers. Like he wanted that.
Yeah. He wanted to create like his own, anthology. Which is admirable as hell.
Exactly. It is. It really is. And really bold when you go, we could keep doing this Myers thing and be just fine for however long. But he was like, I don't want to do this. And he was executive producer on Halloween 2, I think, right?
Yeah.
Wasn't he?
EP? Yeah.
Which is not a good movie.
I hate it.
Just not a good movie. The first one, because I haven't commented yet on the first one.
No, we haven't gone there
you're
yet.
Right. You're right. It is a slasher film in this. If you want it, I would put it in the same descriptive category as Psycho.
Yeah.
The dread, the time that it takes, the fake outs here and there, and then of course, the violence is not particularly graphic and it's not that extensive. But when it comes, it's something.
It's like a suspense film to me, and it's so brilliantly done. And I like everything about it. I just watched it. I watch it every year on Halloween, and huge fan of it. But it's a bit like Jaws in that Jaws 1 is fantastic. Jaws 2 is there. You know, Jaws 3 is weird. Actually, I like Jaws 3 just because it's so technically bad.
And they then, just you get know, better.
And then as you get into the 4s, it's not like the quality. It's like going downstairs, you know.
Right.
It's such an incredible. Yeah, I know a lot of sequels are like that, but it seems like I don't want to get bricks thrown at me, but I feel like Halloween should have been a one and done. I really do.
To make a parallel with Jaws, it's one of those things that I know your average moviegoer or someone that's not, you know, as steeped in this stuff as us is just supposed to, you know, watch it and understand it and view it as it is. But for me, a lot of this stuff is more fascinating when you know the stories behind it. And the story behind Halloween is fascinating when you just you think about what they were, how they were, you know, sort of breaking ground on technique and what they were, you know, the ideology behind it and what he was doing. It really is kind of a, you know, the term tour de force is kind of overused, but it really was like, and it's like a low budget movie that made buckets and buckets and buckets of money.
Oh yeah. And that's why we have like, they're still making Halloween movies.
Now here's something. When did you first become aware of the mask?
Oh, in the 80s. In the 80s. Yeah, that was...
How did you find out?
Comic book shop talk. I probably got told either by my friend Brian or my buddy Sean Sampson, who was into makeup effects and still is doing very well with them. And that would have been a late 80s discovery or an early 90s discovery. I don't remember, but it was well before the internet.
I think it was my cousin David, because he would order some of those big rubber masks sometimes. Like he was that kid.
Yeah, wow.
I'd lucky to have a Ben Cooper. He would get some of the masks from the back of Fangoria in the magazine. And I remember the Shatner and Spock masks being in there and him saying, you know what that is, right? You know? And, but my question is always, Shatner must know. He must be aware.
Shatner's well aware of it. Yeah, I don't think
he's ever commented. Does he get a piece?
I don't know.
I mean, you know what I mean? Like, if he's getting a piece of the mask or whatever Star Trek merchandise gets generated, Star Trek, does he get a little piece of everything Mike Myers? Because that's his face, that's his image up front. We want to know. Send us answers. Write us some letters. Give us the answer. I want to know.
Yeah. Now, have you ever seen Dark Star, his first movie?
I saw Dark Star. I've only seen it once, and I saw it late at night. You know, like local station, late night kind of thing. I remember very little about it. I remember the alien, the beach ball creature thing. I don't know if I really got it. It was more of an endurance test at the time. I'd love to see it again, but I don't remember it very well.
You know what's funny is when I was recuperating from an illness a few years ago, and I had a Roku, I put it on because I was like, I've never seen this, and I want to. And I don't really remember anything about it. I know that it's got Dan O'Bannon in it, and it's very student-y looking, but it's not off-putting. It's still very competently done, and it's clearly very low budget. And I remember one of the things in there that I think the alien is at least voiced by Nick Castle, who is Michael Myers later on, and of course became the director of The Last Starfighter. I found that really interesting. But it's funny that you say that. I don't, even though it should be fresh in my memory, I don't remember anything about it.
That's the quote on the poster from your review. I don't remember anything about it, says Brian Tyler.
Because people would really be turned on by my review.
Right.
There'd be a second question of who the hell's that? That's the same. Actually, I do kind of like, have you seen, like, I'm just going to go down through his films. So it's Assault on Precinct 13. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah. Great movie.
I like
it. It's essentially a remake of Real Bravo.
Real Bravo.
I think it's beautifully done. It's economical. It's really smart. Great performances. They remade it years later with Ethan Hawke and I think Lawrence Fishburne.
I've never seen that.
And maybe John Leguizamo's in it as well.
Ew.
Not as remakes go, not a terrible remake.
Oh, okay.
But the original it starts out very dark. I mean, the opening of this thing is,
yeah,
you know, the first crime is like, holy shit, I can't believe we just went there. But it's very good. And, I think in the story of his life kind of thing, it was like, that was the thing that got enough praise and did well enough that that was able to lead to Halloween, right? Because Halloween was the next...
No, actually, it isn't.
What was the next
Halloween's
one?
His next feature. Oh, no, you're right. It is his next... Sorry, you're right. I had my dates wrong. I like Assault on Precinct 13 for one other reason. As a Planet of the Apes fan, the lead is Austin Stoker, who was in the previous Planet of the Apes film, Battle for the Planet of the Apes, of the previous year. He was McDonald in Battle for the Planet of the Apes. And I'm just, I just want to make sure I'm right with this, but I'm almost positive that Stoker also ended up on the cartoon. I think he was on the Planet of the Apes cartoon, if I'm not mistaken, or I'm getting my people mixed up.
That's awesome if he was.
Yeah, he was Jeff Allen, the astronaut, so I was right. So I'm a huge fan of Austin Stoker, especially his voice.
Maybe I am getting mixed up, because I know he did the Elvis TV movie.
But that was the same year. That was 79. For some reason, I thought it was earlier, but it wasn't.
So Halloween got him the Elvis thing.
Yeah, Halloween was 78. And he also did a TV movie I've never seen that I'm going to go find called Someone's Watching Me. And it stars Adrian Barbeau and Lauren Hutton. Oh, wow. It was made immediately prior to Carpenter's theatrical hit Halloween. So it's funny. Hey, he makes a box office sensation and then does a TV movie. But it was a different time.
Well, and the Elvis thing, too. The fact that he does an Elvis TV movie, which is like, what? And I don't know when I saw it. I definitely saw it. I don't know if I saw it right when it aired. But that began the bromance with Kurt Russell that was very cool for them, was the Elvis thing.
Now, I have seen the Elvis movie. I liked it very much.
I haven't seen it. I was on TV once, and I don't remember much of it, but it was I thought it was, you know, it was fine.
Yeah.
So then he does The Fog, right? That's the next thing he does.
The Fog is his next film. I had never sat down and watched The Fog until this year. I've seen bits and pieces of it. I mean, I always think of it. A lot of his movies, and this is a weird thing, a lot of his movies would end up being on at like midnight on a channel called CTV here.
Okay.
That's how I first saw Escape from New York. That's how I first saw Halloween. That's how, for some reason, those movies always ended up on CTV like 2 or 3 years after they came out in the theater. And that's how I saw The Fog. And I never revisited it. I don't like ghosts personally. So
what is your problem?
I'm sorry. I'm ghostist.
You're clearly ghostist.
Yeah. And it basically turned me off. And then I got Shudder. I bought Shudder for the family. And
yep, that's Shudder.
It was okay, but then I was looking through the selection. It's not really for guys my age. And The Fog was one of their classics. And I was like, I have never seen The Fog. I am going to watch this. And I quite enjoyed it. It was a little hidden gem. It's not my favorite Carpenter film. But,
it's a fun, atmospheric, creepy ghost story.
Yeah. And it has Donald. Did Donald Pleasance in that one? I'm not wrong here.
It's got Hal Holbrook, Adrian Barbeau, Tom Atkins, the great Tom Atkins, Jamie Lee Curtis, someone else. You know who it is? Janet Leigh.
Janet Leigh, right? It doesn't have Pleasance in it. John Houseman, that's why.
John Houseman. He starts it off by telling the tale. What I love about that is, this is just me repeating stories I've heard from him or making ups, was he was with Deborah Hill somewhere, New England or whatever, and a fog was coming in, and he turned to her and said, I wonder what's out in the fog. Like, I wonder what's in there or what's out in there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then that led, why don't you write something? And then that was his pitch, and then he wrote this thing. Jamie Lee Curtis, interestingly enough, said, she couldn't get arrested after Halloween. She did an episode of Buck Rogers.
Right, yeah.
In one of those.
That was a great episode.
But she was like, so when The Fog came along, she was like, here I was in this monster hit of a movie, and I couldn't get in anything. And so when The Fog came along, you know, she always talked about how Deborah Hill and Carpenter were like her, you know, buddies and surrogate parents kind of thing, like, you know, helping out.
You know what? Jamie Lee Curtis ended up in Canada making movies because we had this era that was called like Canucksploitation, where there was tax shelters, and you got crap like Starship Invasions and our favorite, The Shape of Things to Come. And she was in two films, 1980 in Canada. One I remember because it was on CTV all the time, Prom Night and Terror Train. I've never watched Terror Train, but Prom Night sucks.
Terror Train has the guy in that horrible mask.
Yeah.
It's like a clown with a mustache kind of mask or something.
As soon as I found out it was a Canadian film, like, I know how that stuff looks and sounds, and, you know.
So you're racist against ghosts
and prejudiced
against ghosts and your own people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Which, self-hating.
You're a self-hating Canadian, which is very sad to me.
Have you seen Starship Invasions?
You know, is that the one with Christopher Lee?
Yes.
Is he in that? Yes. Oh, seen it. I just watched it today.
What happened is that they became what is known as Canadian content or CanCon. So that shit was on all the time.
So does that mean that they had to like cook bacon during the
No. You know, Bob and Doug McKenzie is a stab at that. It's
at
every 24 hours of your day, every hour of radio, you have to play something that's Canadian content. And it was to protect our culture, and I understand that we're next to a big fun house, and so what I just find is weird is we would just make American slasher movies and terrible science fiction movies that are trying to imitate what you guys were doing. But
right.
Anyway, some good came of it.
Well, she had said that, you know, she was grateful for The Fog because I think Terror Train was either right before or right after Making the Fog. There's a weird... One of the things that stands out the most when you watch The Fog is... talk about a different time. You know, when Tom Atkins picks her up
as
a hitchhiker. And then it's like the next scene...
Right to the screwing.
The next scene... You know, he's lighting a cigarette after sex. They're just hanging out. It's like, oh, he's not going to murder you. You're fine. What could possibly go wrong? But it's got fun stuff in it. Then he goes and does Escape from New York. And by the way, these are, I think, and correct me, stop me if I'm wrong about these, but Halloween, maybe the Elvis thing he wrote or co-wrote, The Fog, Escape from New York, the thing he co-wrote, the script, I think, maybe?
Well, it's an adaptation, I'm sure he had a hand in it.
Big Trouble in Little China. I mean, he didn't just direct this stuff. He wrote most of it, too, or co-wrote.
A lot of it he did the soundtracks for, like...
Which I'll say now, before I forget, I highly recommend... If he ever comes to your town...
He has already, and I missed it. I would love to see him live.
It was wonderful. It was absolutely... Boy. But on Halloween night 2 years ago in Hollywood, and, you know, they run clips. They run packages, like edited versions of the movie when he does the themes or the four-minute, you know, tunes or whatever, and it's just... People showed up in costume and different characters and stuff, and it was really fun. It was really cool to been able to see it. So then the next thing he does is Escape from New York. Now this to me, I don't know why, but this to me, I would probably guess would be your favorite John Carpenter movie because it's close. So in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, of it's stuff close. That you first of all, I want to tell you that I didn't want to watch this as a kid. I assumed it was a horror, and Starlog kept showing pictures of that one freaky guy. And I just thought, no, I don't think I want to see this. You know, I was like 12 or something. And then some kid I knew who had, like, we didn't own a VCR and we didn't have pay television, so like all this stuff wasn't really all that available to me. And most Carpenter movies were described to me by friends. This is the honest truth. I remember a kid describing Escape from New York and telling me how much fun it was. One of my closest friends to this day is the person who described The Thing to me, and I always think of him because he did a really good job. You know, he had seen it like a million times because he had a Betamax. Yeah, I didn't get a VCR till like 1985. So okay. I was a little bit of a, you know, social misfit in that regard. Right. But yeah, I can remember thinking that Escape from New York was scary and I didn't really want to watch a horror movie. And then this kid I knew just basically said, "It's not a horror movie." And then he explained it. And the first time it was available on television, which was probably like 83, I watched it. I watched it on Buffalo 29. I remember really liking it and being mad that I had missed a bit of the starting.
And by the way, talk about a cast.
Oh, yeah.
Kurt Russell, Lee Van Cleef. Isaac, Harry Dean Stanton, Adrian Barbeau, Ernest Borgnine. I mean, who am I missing? What more do you need? That is, you know, gold standard right there as a cast.
I really like it. It is definitely in my top three. It's probably not my number one. It's close.
I figured it was up there.
Yeah.
It's got everything you dig. It's post-apocalyptic. It's, kind of camp, not campy, but kind of, you know, it's got that vibe to it and great character actors in it and slightly nihilistic and stuff. It's, you know, all that Italian stuff you dig from like the early 80s. And
oh, yeah, that's something I'd really like to touch upon. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Italy in the 1980s. In the early 1980s, there's this little sweet spot just before the Road Warrior hit. Because after the Road Warrior hit, oh no, maybe it was around that time, but there was this little sweet spot where they would take movies and rip off. The Warriors, Escape from New York, and the Road Warrior became like Italy's three favorite things. And they would combine them. So you get this like 1990, the Bronx Warriors, which it's, you know, their hero is a guy named Trash. And then the sequel to 1990, the Bronx Warriors, is called Escape from the Bronx. Like, they just, you know, just so you know, we're totally ripping off Carpenter and the Warriors here. And my other favorite one is one called After the Fall of New York, which stars a Kurt Russell lookalike who's called Parsifal. And it's a post-apocalyptic New York. He has to go into New York to rescue a woman. And it's just batshit. I mean, there's monkey people and craziness. And, you know, I think it's got guys on horseback with laser guns. You know, that bullshit. But
if it doesn't, it should.
I love the craziness this movie inspired. I love its knockoffs just as much as I love it.
Isn't Vic Morrow in Bronx Warriors?
He is in 1990, The Bronx Warriors. He is also in the greatest Jaws ripoff ever called, I think it's called The Last Shark. I think it's an Italian movie where it's just basically a shot-for-shot remake of Jaws with Vic Morrow as Quint.
That's brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
Morrow, he did well with the Italians.
He is, he also... Vic Morrow, I only like Vic Morrow from really odd choices that he made towards the end of his life. I think with Twilight Zone, he may have actually had a bit of a resurgence here. But he did another movie called Message from Space absolutely. Yeah, we should do an episode on that. I should make you watch it. Bizarre Japanese ripoff of Star Wars, with Vic Morrow playing a guy who has a weird relationship with his robot. That's all I'm going to say about it.
Yeah, that rings a bell.
I'm sure you've seen it. It's a weird movie.
it might be one of those like Amazon Prime things that's popped up or something that I've come up.
Oh, that could be. It's definitely streaming somewhere. I think it's streaming on Amazon Prime. But if you watch it, we could do a show about it.
All right. I'm on it.
Because I've seen it like 10,000 times.
So then comes what I would say would be my favorite Carpenter movie.
I would say the same.
Which is The Thing.
The
remake of The Thing from Another World. Which,
critically lambasted when it came out.
Yeah, I'd say everybody knows this story by now, but it was critically mauled.
Yep.
I mean, I remember we always referenced the Leonard Maltin paperback book that we carried around like a couple of nerds,
stupid,
you know, crossing on 15. I think Leonard Maltin book gave it either 1.5 or half a star.
Yeah.
Said, you know,
Siskel and Ebert freaking hated it.
Vomit-inducing, you know, make of da-da-da-da-da, he completely misses the point, blah, blah, blah. Well, we loved it because for all the reasons they hated it, you know, when we were kids and everything. But beyond all the gore and the creativity in that stuff, which, you know, I'm, again, a broken record about it, but it's extraordinary how well that stuff holds up, how all practical effects hold up in a way that not many practical effects movies with this kind of distance hold up that well.
There's, you know how you watch something like Total Recall and Arnold's taking that thing out of his nose, and it's, you know, it's the same guy who did it, Rob Bottin.
Yeah.
But it just, you know when it's, what's like, I've been watching a lot of 80s movies lately, and you know when it's an animatronic head, you know. The Thing is really hard to sit there, and because it's so visceral, and things are coming out of things, and you don't know what's happening, I think
it's Rob Bottin, and I think Rob Bottin was a protege of Rick Baker's.
Yeah.
And I think the story goes, I think, that Rick Baker was going to do The Howling, I think. He had been friends with John Landis before. He was going to do The Howling. He was excited because, I get to do a werewolf thing. And then just as he's sort of prepping for that, the Landis movie gets greenlit. And he's like, I got to go do this thing with John Landis, but I got a guy. And so he brings Bottin into the fold for The Howling. And Bottin did the makeup, a lot of the werewolf stuff for The Howling. And so then he was sort of in that realm and kind of getting stuff. And then along comes The Thing. And it's design-wise, just when you look at the drawings and the design, I believe it was Carpenter. It was Carpenter's idea. Like, well, this thing can be anything, right? And so what if it's halfway between one thing and another? And what if it's this and what if it's that? And I think that was the brief. And then Bottin or whoever else was on board just went to town with the designs and the concepts and stuff. And it's hard to describe just how far out this stuff is and how you know, leaps and bounds, you know, how much further it goes than anything that was in its neighborhood at the time. Like, it's really trippy, weird stuff conceptually. But more than that, it's just a wonderful movie. It's just the build and the atmosphere, the performances, the it's minimal writing, minimal dialogue and everything. Russell is fantastic. It's just a great, it's just, I don't know if it's a horror, you know, but kind of thriller and sort of, paranoid kind of thriller, you know, or early 80s kind of paranoia. And it's just, I could watch it, you know, every month. I could just put that thing on and it's perfection. Everybody in it is so good. Every performance.
I'm especially fond of Donald Moffat because I'm a huge fan of the Logan's Run television series. And he just wasn't a guy who got a lot of the best lines in something, even though he was a really good actor. And
right.
He has, of course, I think the best line in the entire film in the thing. I think that the Carpenter version is probably closer. I mean, the gore is not there, but is actually probably closer to the original novella than the 50s, you know, the acclaimed 50s Howard Hawks version.
Right.
Which I'm actually not fond of. I think it's a competently well-made film, but it's, you know, it's a blood-sucking monster, vegetable man. And
yeah. I mean, I ended up years later, because I just to be able to see it, having seen the remake and everything, and it's, you know, it's a fine movie, but once you've gone to the Carpenter thing, it's like, talk about, I mean, that is the way to do a remake, where it's not, it's taking it in a very, very different direction. Conceptually, it's, you know, the through line is there, but it's very, very, very different. And I think it really messed him up. It really, he was severely disappointed that movie did not find an audience, and that it was so...
I can't fucking believe that bombed.
Yeah.
They blame E.T. at the time being the big hit, but I'm sorry, that what an original and unique take on something.
Yeah, and we talked about that in the 82 episode we did,
yeah.
how so much of the stuff in 82 was overshadowed by certain other things, but that didn't really find an audience at first, or it took a while,
yeah.
And then in hindsight become these high watermarks of the year, you know, basically Blade Runner being one, and, you know, The Thing, another one. And so then he does Starman.
No, he did Christine.
Oh, he did Christine. Oh, shit. I forgot about Christine.
Yeah, I've never seen it.
So, you know, it's fine, but there's a reason that I forgot that he made Christine. Like, it's not...
Can I confide something in you, and I hope it doesn't jade people? I don't like Stephen King horror movies. I like Stephen King movies based on other stories. I tend to like those very much, actually. But
like Shawshank, Green Mile.
Yeah, Shawshank, Green Mile, Misery. I don't consider really a horror. I think those are really well-made films. Stand By Me. I do like Creepshow, but for the most
Let me ask you this then.
Yeah.
Have you tried watching Castle Rock on Hulu?
No.
Well, I'd be curious to know what you think of that. Castle Rock, it's an original show. They use the universe of Stephen King stories and characters to tell another story. So in other words, you come across a character, you know, three episodes in, and you hear their last name, and you go, oh, that's the kid. She must be the daughter of the guy that ran the curio shop in Needful Things, or, you know, whatever.
Oh, I see.
So it's like this original thing is if everybody lives in this town of Castle Rock, and the Shawshank prison is there, and yada, yada, yada. And now I understand that each season is standalone. Last season was, I thought it was a bit of an endurance test. Some very good stuff in it, but very underdeveloped. Sissy Spacek is in it, and she's incredible in it, season one. And you go, oh, Sissy Spacek, yeah, Carrie, of course. Well, this season, it's one episode in, and I think this episode is already better than most of what the first season was. And Tim Robbins is in it. He's got a part in it. So, you know, and it, you know, you recognize certain names or certain little concepts that come into the narrative and stuff. And it's all, you know, making an original show all out of the universe of Stephen King's kind of New England or, you know, whatever things come from. But it's not necessarily horror. Might be something you would appreciate, maybe. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
I'll check it out. After I get through Watchmen and Doom Patrol. I've never seen Christine. I've seen little bits of it. The concept, even though I'm a huge Carpenter fan, the concept didn't really appeal to me, so I can't really speak to that one.
Well, I just remember, even as a kid, seeing the poster or seeing the trailer and thinking...
hardback book.
Is this really now we've gone there with cars and whatever? So I forgot he did that. So there's a Stephen King. So he's adapting that.
Well, he was also working on Firestarter, and he got fired because of the.
Oh right.
He got fired because the thing bombed, and you know he was no longer hot. And I think when you're talking about like him being somewhat scarred, that probably has a lot to do with it. You know, stuff like that where...
Yeah, I forgot about the Firestarter thing. And then Starman, was Starman an original of his? Was that an original script sort of thing? Or was that he was hired as like a gun for hire for that?
You know, it's been so long. He did not write it. So, okay.
And so that was it. And that was a big mainstream hit.
It was. In fact, it was my first date.
Really?
Yeah. It was not, you know.
Mine was Barfly.
Barfly. You know how to treat a lady.
And you think I'm kidding, but I'm not.
Really?
Well, it's one of my first dates, yeah.
Oh, wow. I rented that with my sister. Which
she stuck around.
Awkward and weird.
Yeah.
You know, what are we watching? But yeah, I remember we went with a bunch of friends. I think I was in the ninth grade when this came out, and I remember that really well. I enjoyed that film. I didn't really love the follow up television series all that much, but I did like movie.
So this thing comes out. It's a fairly mainstream hit. I think Jeff Bridges, my boy, Jeff Bridges, got nominated for Best Actor for that, if I'm not mistaken. I think that was his first nomination, was the lead for Starman.
It's a pretty good performance, and I do admit that I have a very soft spot for Karen Allen as well.
Oh, we couldn't be friends if you didn't.
Yeah, Best Actor nomination for Starman, which is really nice.
Oh, he did.
Yeah,
look at that. There you go.
And Karen Allen received a nod for Best Actress. Oh, that was from the Academy. Never mind. So
that was from the Saturn Awards.
It was the Saturn Awards.
From the Poughkeepsie Sci-Fi Best Awards,
where you're competing against women who took their top off and screamed.
So then, maybe I'm wrong, but I think the next thing he does is Big Trouble in Little China.
It is. That is, and this one is also going to be a bit of a controversial opinion. Not a big fan.
I love it. I saw it.
Really?
I saw it in the theater. I saw it in the theater with a kid, with a dude, a friend of mine from high school. We would tell people about it at school, and they were like, "What's this called? What is it?" And we're like, "You gotta just see it. I can't explain. It's just funny. He's a total smartass, and it's just..." And we loved it. We loved it. But nobody saw that movie. Like nobody. It really was kind of... That was another bit of an undoing for him, because that did not do anything. And it was... I think he was trying to open it up to a series of movies, maybe with this character.
All I remember is my sister rented it. My sister would come home from university in the summers, and her friends, you know, my parents would disappear, and her friends would like watch movies. And one night I came down and Big Trouble in Little China, and I mean, my God, I was a fan of Carpenter at this point, and I loved Kurt Russell, and they were howling. They loved it, and I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the pacing. I've tried to rewatch it. I do occasionally put it on and go, no, still not for me. I don't know what it is about it. I know that like it's very aggrandized, especially if you grew up in the 80s. It's like a complete cult classic. And I understand that when you see something at a certain age, it just becomes... it imprints on you, and I assume that's what's going on here, and I won't argue that because I've got that going on too, but it didn't do anything for me then, and it doesn't do anything for me now.
It is, again, I put it in the, I put it as a close cousin, not quite incestuous, but a maybe second or third cousin to The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension.
Yeah.
There's so much in it that is bonkers, that you just kind of, by the time you get to the point in Buckaroo Banzai where they're talking about Orson Welles and the War of the Worlds radio broadcast and stuff, you just go, okay, I have to go with this because this thing is nuts. And I just enjoy being in it, sort of. And Big Trouble in Little China is not for everyone, certainly. And it's got weird tone and sort of weird pacing. And some of the jokes are just huge, and some are, then it goes a little sinister. Doesn't quite know what it is, but that's kind of one of the reasons that I kind of love it. And Russell's just a joy to watch in the thing. He's clearly having a ball.
Yeah, that's one thing I will agree with, is he does look like he is having a fun time.
Oh, he looks like he could do this forever in this part.
Yeah.
And again, this to me is like a testament to their friendship and how much he loved making movies with him, because, I mean, he made another one after this too, but like, he was, at this point, I think he was in Silkwood, and he was doing, you know, The Mean Season, and he was doing all kinds of stuff where it was much more, he got out of the Disney thing and, did the things he did with Carpenter, but he, you know, to go, I'm going to go make this wacky thing with John, because we're going to have a lot of fun doing it and stuff. So I love that about it. So then the next thing he did would have been Prince of Darkness, right? After.
Yes. And
I saw Darkness in the theater. I think that's a very underrated.
Completely.
Horror. Wouldn't you agree?
I do. And in fact, I only recently, probably in the last year, I think probably last Halloween, I put that on because I was like, you know, saying to the wife, underrated classic, not appreciated. Most people haven't seen it. Really interesting take on the entire concept of Satan, and not one you'll see in another movie.
And might be not only Alice Cooper's finest work, but Jameson Parker's as well.
Parker's fine. You mean the non Gerald McCraney brother?
The other Simon.
The other Simon. For years in my basement apartment at one place, had a still of Alice Cooper from Prince of Darkness on my wall, because I was a big Alice Cooper fan, and it was a cool shot. I really do like this film. I think it's, it's not going to be the most popular Carpenter film, but it is, again, an original concept, an original story.
And, yeah.
You know,
it's creepy, man.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really actually kind of liked it. I still like it. I still think it's like, I like it better than I do Big Trouble in Little China, just because. What's that?
No, okay. Go ahead. You said
I prefer it to Big Trouble in Little China.
I get that. Yeah. I totally get that. I picked it up on Blu-ray a couple years back and hadn't seen it, but I knew there was this new edition that came out on Blu-ray, and I hadn't seen it in maybe over 10 years or so. And I was really kind of shocked at how well, especially the front half of it holds up, and how disturbing. It's freaking disturbing. And it's a great concept. And he said in the extras, it's exactly what you said. Like, how many new takes on the devil have we gotten?
Yeah.
You know, that was his whole point, kind of, was to try to do that. Jameson Parker, Donald Pleasance, maybe the last Carpenter Pleasance thing. Is that right?
I can't think of another. You're probably right. I mean, I know Donald Pleasance went on to do Halloween movies till the end of his life, and oh God,
bless his heart.
Oh God, like I always make that joke of like Michael Myers is over. They're like, you know, get that man out of this set. You know, like it's so bad. I think it's like Halloween 15 or whatever, and he can barely speak. And it always reminds me a bit of, like, I heard that Boris Karloff, towards the end of his life, was, like, filming a scene in Mexico, and then, like, he would go off to the side and use an air oxygen tent, you know, to breathe. And it's like, what the fuck did Boris Karloff need to be, like, he wasn't broke. You know, I don't understand that work ethic.
But, you know what it was? It was for the ladies.
Oh yeah, yeah. Because when you've got an oxygen tent, you're
in the love the oxygen.
So I love Prince of Darkness.
I'm gonna grab Prince of Darkness right now. In fact, I'm gonna put Prince of Darkness on tonight while we're doing this.
Why don't you do it right now? Yeah.
Yeah. Let's put it on. Put
you
the phone
do a
down.
Running commentary, and I can't see the film, so I'll just have to ask you what's going on.
Right, exactly. The devil thing. So Pleasance, Jameson Parker, which is an odd choice. No offense to Jameson Parker. I was a big Simon and Simon fan because they came on right after Mad Men, as far as I remember, and I'm a huge Mad Men fan.
Yeah.
Big fan of that show. Not Jameson Parker didn't make a lot of movies.
No, he did not.
Weird thing, like get that guy. I don't know who. I forget who the woman was, but the guy, the Asian kid from Big Trouble, is in it.
What's his name from Riptide? Murray Boz.
Murray Boz from Riptide's in it. That's right.
Yeah.
Who was also the Daniel Stern character in the television version of Breaking Away, the television sitcom version of the 1979 film Breaking Away.
I used to watch that show.
It was a great show. I loved that show.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's that. So that and that bombed. As far as I
Big
remember.
Time.
Also might have been my first, and I can't believe I'm saying this on national television, first movie in the theater that I went to stoned.
Oh.
Was Prince of Darkness.
Oh, yeah. We can't be friends.
Which obviously made the creepiness a little more palpable for me.
Well, that angel dust will get you, right?
Right, and this was bad angel time.
Yeah.
Let me tell you,
yeah.
We got not the stuff they used for the Maureen Stapleton Gene Stapleton movie.
Oh, yeah.
So there was that, and then he kind of does he kind of float after that? Kind of, or the next thing
he makes They Live.
They Live! Oh my God, They Live!
Which is definitely one of my favorite Carpenter films, and. This is where I don't know who to... If I had to have a top three, I wouldn't know who to kick out of the... Because I've got four I think are amazing. I love They Live.
Oh, my God.
I saw it in the theater. It was one of my favorite films of 1988, for sure.
Oh, my God.
I've shown it to my children because I think it's important. Its message is more important now. And
I want to say this about They Live. Can I say something about it? Because I think it's wonderful.
I think
it's great. I watched it again recently. Don't you feel like it takes a little while? I mean, there's one thing about buildup, but by the time poor Roddy Piper gets
the glasses on,
to get the glasses on him and figured out in someone else, we're an hour into the movie.
It does I remember showing it to my children, and they have half the attention span I probably had then. They were all antsy and stirry and wanted it to get going. And I had not noticed that personally because I like the film and I know where it's going. And it's got that long allegory of where America is, this America.
Right.
And, he's trying to really set the frame. And I like that, but yeah, I agree with you. I've seen that firsthand.
Okay, so I'm not wrong that it kind of... And then, of course, we've got what is one of the greatest or silliest, depending on who you talk to, and longest fistfights in the history of motion pictures.
Well, that is... Yeah, that it... I don't... Roddy's a wrestler. He had to bring that with him, I guess.
Wait, whoa. What do you mean he's a wrestler? What are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, he's a Canadian, too, by the way.
I thought he went to RADA.
RADA, yes. he's a Scottish-born actor.
No, but it's a ton of fun. It's a fun... I mean, it's funny that I forgot about that. And, like, look at that. From 78... Really, from 78 to 88, look at the body of work.
Oh, yeah.
He never stopped working. The genre stuff up the yin yang. The only thing he didn't do was a western, but he practically did with Assault on Precinct 13.
He did kind of do a couple of westerns, but in his own way in the 90s. And I think it's interesting because after that comes what a lot of people would call the decline. I still think there's some great movies in there. But
okay.
you know, he opens the 90s with Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
Oh,
which, you know, I think has a lot to do with attaching itself to Chevy Chase, whose career.
And by the way, nothing should get attached to Chevy Chase other than syphilis.
I love Chevy Chase, but he made some terrible things in the 90s.
There's very little that he just made a lot of mistakes. He should have stuck around a little bit longer on SNL. But anyway,
he's a notorious asshole. And I think he'd even admit that. I liked Memoirs of Invisible Man. I actually kind of liked it when it came out. I have not revisited it.
Who's the heavy in that? It's him and Daryl Hannah. Sam Neill.
Yeah.
Oh, so that would make sense.
He's fucking great. He worked in it too.
So that was 90.
That was 92.
92.
I remember when that came out because I was moving into a dorm room at the time and was like, oh, I want to see that.
What comes next?
In the Mouth of Madness, and this is personal to me because my close friend Sean, who I talked about earlier, he worked on that. He had this bucket list of directors he wanted to work with, and it was Romero and Carpenter, and he got all of them. He managed to work with all of them. He worked on In the Mouth of Madness, and I remember him telling me about the set and all that stuff because I'd call him and ask him how it was going, you know. So we were really super excited to see it, and we saw it opening night. We were living in Toronto at the time. I remember it. It's based on Lovecraft, but not based on anything he wrote.
Right.
And I think it's a really interesting movie. It's all filmed in Toronto. I really like it, personally.
Speaking of Stephen King, it's riffing on, you know, an author that's in the Stephen King kind of vein and the stuff that he writes and stuff. But the layers of it.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, it took me two viewings to really appreciate how tight that thing is, how smart it is. Like a great Twilight Zone episode, kind of like a great, you know, the sort of triple quadruple endings, you know, kind of things of it. Sam Neill's terrific in it. It's got a very dark sense of humor, but it winks at the audience a lot. But it is disturbing. There's imagery in it that is very unsettling and kind of, the little inn, the little old lady behind the counter at the inn that they go to, and just the real sense. I mean, they could tell they didn't have a huge budget. They gave you a sense of just the kid on the bike.
The kid on the bike. I was gonna say.
Oh,
yeah.
The kid on the bike is nightmare fuel.
Yeah.
And it's a nothing effect. It's just, you know, I don't want to spoil it, but it is what it is. And then like, okay, let's shoot this thing, and it's terrifying.
Yeah.
It's absolutely terrifying. That is, I think, of any of his stuff, I bet that's the thing people have seen the least.
Yeah, and it's the one they see.
I'm sorry. Memoirs of an Invisible Man is probably the thing that people have seen the least, and then In the Mouth of Madness, I would think.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that Memoirs of an Invisible Man got better over the years, but I bet you if you reevaluation of In the Mouth of Madness is definitely necessary. It's something that kind of got largely ignored, and it had some great moments. And I especially liked, there was Charlton Heston's in it, and there's a subtle nod to the Omega Man in it. Isn't that, I can't remember. And this could be the memory cheats and spoilers. If you haven't heard this, skip ahead a minute, but at the end of the film, you know, the movie came out. And it drove everyone crazy, and it's the end of the world. And Sam Neill, I think the film ends with Sam Neill in a theater watching it.
Yes.
And it sort of reminded me of the Omega Man, because the Omega Man opens with Charlton Heston in a theater watching a movie.
Well, to be fair, lots of things remind you of the Omega Man. Terms of Endearment reminds you of the Omega Man.
Sometimes, yes.
You see Omega Man in many, many things. Well, but I think you might be right. That sounds like a wink to me. That definitely sounds like a wink.
It's in my defense, Shirley MacLaine looks a lot like Anthony Zerbe.
Yes, that is true.
Anthony Zerbe actually pulls me out of things because I've seen the Omega Man so much. I was watching him on Kung Fu recently, and it's just, you know, he's a great actor, but I always...
Anthony Zerbe is in License to Kill, Timothy Dalton's second Bond film. He's got a supporting part, and he's wonderful. He's wonderful in it. But that's the kind of thing, the last time I saw In the Mouth of Madness, or watched it, it was the kind of thing I'm watching going, I really truly felt this was a guy that hadn't lost a bit of his...
No, I thought it was a fantastic film.
You know, it was 94 or 95, whatever it was, and I thought, well, this guy, you watch and you think, well, this guy's got another 10 years of this. Like, he's going to be churning out this kind of stuff.
Even the opening music is amazing. With the showing the papers going by and all that stuff. You really thought Carpenter still got it. And then he stumbles. He stumbles because in 95 he remade Village of the Damned.
Oh, shit.
And unlike his remake of The Thing, he adds nothing.
He has Mark Hamill. Let's not forget.
He has Mark Hamill. Mark Hamill not looking his best.
But Christopher Reeve.
Kirstie Alley.
Kirstie Alley, and there's another prominent actress in it. I think
Linda
a blonde. Kozlowski.
Yeah.
Crocodile Dundee's wife.
Ex-wife.
Ex-wife. Beg your pardon. It's also about. That movie's about an hour and 10 minutes. It seems like there's nothing to that movie. It is so in and out, which is a great. Village of the Damned was what I want to say early '60s, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe
it's so atmospheric,
creepy, and at the time, a very racy topic when you think about it.
You can't
ignore what's being posited here.
Yeah.
And it was based on a story, I believe, The Midwich Cuckoos or something.
Yeah, by John Wyndham.
John Wyndham, who did Triffids, right?
He did the Triffids, and he also did another book called The Chrysalids that...
Right.
I'm sorry, but Stan Lee and Jack Kirby must have read that, because it's very much the X-Men. And I also find that John... What is his name? Roger Price, I think, ripped it off for the Tomorrow People, too, where it's just about teenagers who, in a post-apocalyptic world, teenagers start being able to telepathically talk to one another.
You know, every time I hear the title, The Tomorrow People, I think of Ziggy Marley.
Yeah, I know.
No, I do. I don't. It's like an automatic switch that goes off in my head. I wish it didn't.
Yeah.
But I hear Tomorrow People, and I go...
I used to do that while watching the show. That one I would say was a big miss for Carpenter. I'm not terribly fond of it was remade, it was done in color, the eyes now for some reason like they had CGI for the eyes. But the effect in the black and white movie is still scarier. And
he was phoning it in.
It felt phoned in. I don't like, I think Carpenter was a big fan too.
Oh yeah. Oh, totally. What was that? What came after that? Was it James Woods?
The next thing that came out was Escape from L.A.
Oh, Christ, on a pogo stick.
Oh, did that not age well? I bought a new HDTV a few years ago, and I thought, I'm going to have to check out a movie on Netflix and see how this looks, and I put on Escape from L.A., and, like, the sub that Snake Plissken goes in looks like a screensaver from, you know, my shitty computer 10 years ago. It's a straight up friggin' remake of Escape from New York, which I hate. And there's some bright spots in it, like Bruce Campbell has a fun little cameo.
Peter Fonda shows up in it.
It's got Pam Grier in it. It's got
Pam Grier.
It's got Steve Buscemi.
Peter Fonda, got a surfer kind of dude.
Oh, but that's the worst scene in the film. I mean,
oh, it is. Yeah. But it's like you can see what he's trying to kind of do. Like, I was so pumped for this movie. I was so ready for this movie because I thought, you know, I'm living in Hollywood now. Like, ooh, they're making this thing. I can't believe it's happening. And like, now we're in a post Tarantino world, and Buscemi's in it, and Kurt is back, and all these faces are going. It's going to be so good. I was there opening night at the Chinese theater. I think it was Chinese or maybe the Egyptian. I forget. And it was just like, oh my God, this is so freaking bad. You know, even Russell was missing the tone. Even Russell was just like, what are you doing? Like,
yeah.
You know,
it has a few good scenes. But yeah, and I actually would have liked, because the movie ends with Snake Plissken blacking out all of the United States from power, basically turning the United States into the Wild West again. And
right.
Like, that should have been the movie you made. You know,
right.
that would have been freaking, you know, the adventures of Snake Plissken not escaping from something. You know, I realized that it's a business and people want to see the same thing over and over again. But that really could have been a more interesting take, is to just put Snake Plissken in other situations.
It also just looked bad. It's kind of like, okay, now it's many years later. Kurt Russell's a big name. You got a big studio, whatever. We can do this thing. Effects have made improvements in leaps and bounds. Now we can really get a scope for what the world looks like, you know, post Madness or, you know, whatever. And then you're there, and you never don't think you're on a soundstage, or you're around.
That's the other thing. It just looks.
Well, they built a sign and some grass, and you just walk in front of it, and that you're like, where are the locations? Like, what are we? You know, here's you can really do some fun stuff with the earthquakes that have decimated Los Angeles and whatever. And it never looked anything but super cheap, I thought.
There's something about it that it looks like it's green screen filmed. And,
right.
Especially the surfing scene. Yeah, like I said.
I forgot about the submarine. Jesus, I forgot about that.
Oh, it's so bad.
It's so bad.
But I still went to the theater to see his next movie, which was Vampires, starring James Woods.
That's the James Woods thing. I don't hate that movie.
I actually kind of like it. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Why? What about it? What?
I just liked the idea that these guys work for the Catholic Church, and they're like slayers.
Yeah.
And
Who's Okay, it's James Woods. The chameleon like talents of James Woods. What will he do next?
He'll annoy you on Twitter with his terribleness.
What performance will he surprise us with next? It's James Woods. Who else
here
is in that
he's working
movie?
To play a douchebag. It's got James Woods, Daniel Baldwin.
Daniel Baldwin, the forgotten Baldwin, yes.
They all just look like Alec, except they're younger or heavier. Like,
they're hungover.
Yeah, they're hungover. And the biggest star in it for me, because I'm here doing this show, would be Maximilian Schell. I've seen like three movies with him in it: The Black Hole, Hamlet on Mystery Science Theater, this. As he's like a turncoat who betrays the Slayers to the Catholic because he's going to become a vampire, and they think they wake up some super powerful vampire, and that's the whole plot of the film.
There you go. If anyone's going to do it, it's the German.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You can't trust those people.
Pretty much. Can't trust them. I forgot he was in that. Okay, so that's Vampires. Am I wrong? Or did that have the letter S was a dollar sign in the logo?
No, you are wrong. You are wrong. I don't know what that is, but I'm sure it exists.
Okay. I don't know what I'm thinking of or why there's something that had a dollar sign
Arliss.
In the title. As Arliss. I get John Carpenter's Vampires mixed up with Arliss a lot.
Arliss is way scarier.
Yeah, I get most of... I think Robert Wall is in every John Carpenter movie until I sit down to watch it and go, when is Wall showing up at the wisecracks? Oh, I don't know why. What's taking so long?
I want this to be laugh a minute.
What comes after vampires? Please remind me because I am drawing a blank.
Ghost of Mars.
That has a dollar sign in its title.
I think you're that obsessed with bling, sir.
Both S's are dollar signs, and they throw a letter C in there with the sense. No, I don't know what
this
I'm thinking
of.
This
is another one that I get why people don't like it. I love the friggin' concept of the film. Like,
so this is a prison break on Mars, right?
It's almost Assault on Precinct 13 again. Where right. It is, I think there's a criminal. I think he's played by Ice Cube, and there's the Austin Stoker part is played by Natasha Henstridge, who is big at the time because of
the feces
movies. I don't like those movies. Jason Statham's in it.
Statham, yeah.
And
Statham.
Pam Grier. It's got even Robert Carradine is in this one.
Can we just agree that right off the bat that Pam Grier makes just about anything better? Not necessarily watchable, but putting Pam Grier into just about anything.
I'm thinking about stuff and Pam Grier shows up, it is better. She did not get her due. Like she sat out such a long period of time. And it's like, well, she was really great. Why did she have such a career lull like that?
Well, because she came out of that, she was big, but it was in a particular genre of pictures. And, everything started to kind of get, moved on. And it was like, oh, that was a particular time. Like, we don't want anything to do with those folks. By the way, speaking of, if you haven't watched it yet, please watch the Eddie Murphy, Dolomite Is My Name.
Watch it Friday.
You just loved it.
How great is
not only Murphy in that, where you're 10 minutes in going, oh, somebody please give this guy more to do or more comedy or whatever. He's just, he's so good in it. But how great was Wesley Snipes?
He's amazing.
Good Lord.
I was having, when I first heard he was playing D'Urville Martin, I kind of thought, really him? Oh my God, he's so good. He's so good. And
he's still in the movie. He kind of steals it, I think.
The only
he's
thing that kind of had me going, "Hey," was they shoved scenes like they made Dolomite this catch-all of a film, and they were showing scenes from Moore's other films, the more crazier, outlandish stuff. I think that I personally, because I had watched an interview with Eddie Murphy, because I was so excited about this, you have no idea, that I think Eddie Murphy was such a fan, he just, like, those scenes are some of his favorites that we ever did. So it was included, and I kind of was like, well, that's kind of done out of love. And who cares? It's not inaccurate. He did make those films. He just didn't make them all at once.
We're only going to get one shot at this to tell the story, the Rudy Ray Moore story. Let's just throw everything in.
It's a fantastically uplifting story when I think about it. I tend to think of Rudy Ray Moore as that guy sitting at the table at ChillerCon that I forgot to talk to, and he looked a bit sad. But he really did have an amazing renaissance, all those rappers bringing on his albums. We should just do a Dolomite.
Oh, yeah.
We should do a whole Dolomite episode.
I'd be down for that. And the writers, Larry blah blah and what's his name that wrote it? Who wrote Ed Wood?
Yeah.
Which is perfect. It's like perfect. If you're gonna tell this story, who are the guys you want to write this thing? I don't know if I ever told you, but 6 months or a year or whatever it was, I was at Musso and Frank one night.
Yeah,
and I was
sitting at the friend of yours was working on it. Yeah.
I think I told you that, yeah? And the guy, Larry, but I recognized him from Trailers from Hell. I knew his face. I knew his name for years, but I knew his face because of Trailers from Hell.
Yeah.
And so we got to chatting, and I said, what are you working on? And he's like, oh, we're doing a Dolomite thing with Eddie Murphy. And I was like, oh, shit. So that was, and I thought, well, it's perfect. Those guys telling a you know, there's fiction in both stories, and they're making a condensed, you know, version or whatever, but to make the uplifting stuff work, you know, his friendship with the woman that he befriended, and it's filthy and it's very R-rated. Yes. But I thought it was very well done, and he was wonderful in it, and Snipes just stole the thing. But I'm sorry, back to Pam.
I just want to say, because I don't want to forget it, is I hope he gets nominated for an Oscar, because I really want on the Oscar night to hear Dolomite said. You know what I mean? I really wanted James Franco to win last year, just so that somehow Tommy Wiseau was connected to an Oscar.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I just, oh, yeah. I needed that to happen.
Well, it's like Martin Landau, you know, who comes out of the Actors Studio, works with Hitchcock, you know, then, you know, no offense to Space 1999 at all. That was a big, big, big show. But by the end of the 70s, he's the villain on, you know, the Harlem Globetrotters meet Gilligan's Island, crash land on Gilligan's Island.
Oh, yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So then he gets, you know, here's a big budget Hollywood movie being made about what's considered the worst filmmaker of all time, Ed Wood, with a bigger budget than anyone's connected to him saw in their lifetime.
Yeah.
And Landau comes along and wins Best Supporting Actor for it.
Yeah.
Like, he wins the award for playing a washed-up actor, you know, etc. And the layers of it are just... And Murphy, I watch the thing and you just go, why is nobody getting him to make just flat... What is the problem in... There's got to be piles of scripts of people that go, I'd love to do something for Eddie Murphy. I'd love to get him back to... the stuff that he used to do and away from the, you know, 12 wishes on the like Christmas tree bullshit that he does. And he's just terrific in it. He just lets loose he is so good in it.
He's wonderful. I want to see more. And you forget that you're watching Eddie Murphy, and that's good acting.
So I got to watch it again. So ridiculous, and everybody in it is great. So Pam Grier is, Cash Vampires. What's it called?
Career in Ghosts of Mars.
Ghosts of Mars.
Yes.
Dollar signs in the title. Right.
And
okay. Ghosts of Mars.
Yeah, actually.
For the heist movie.
Well, no. It's Ghosts of Mars. Let's look at that title. Basically, the dead Martians possess human colonists on Mars, leaving Natasha Henstridge and Ice Cube and Jason Statham kind of like it's Assault on Precinct 13 with ghost Martians.
Right.
I honestly like the film, but you know, honestly, it isn't well liked, and it's pretty much I think Carpenter did one other film called The Ward, which I've never seen. I think it's a smaller budgeted film.
That's a more recent one.
Well, recent is like 9 years ago.
The one with Blake Lively or somebody like that or something?
No, this guy, Amber Heard.
Amber Heard. Yeah. 9 years old.
Yeah. And it bombed. It didn't even make it. I think it made for $10 million and made $1 million. I'd never heard of it. I didn't even know he directed
Wait, didn't he do... When did Body Bags happen?
You know, I was just going to bring that up. We kind of crossed over that. That was in the early 90s.
Okay.
And, Carpenter was very directly involved with that. I think I don't know if he was a producer, but him and Toby Hooper were the directors of the first couple of stories. I haven't seen that in so long.
I just came across it because it is on Prime or Shudder.
Yeah, it's on Shudder. That's right. Yeah.
And I think I saw it on VHS or something. I don't know what. So I didn't remember it at all. I remember he was on camera. I remember that he's the crypt keeper, sort of, you know, walking us through these things. But I rewatched it the other night.
Stacey Keach get eaten by his wig or something like that.
Stacey Keach goes to a hair place to get more hair because he's so paranoid about being bald, and things get out of hand. There are some fun concepts that are let down by the budget. The place that, you know, the whole thing of him being the guy that works in a morgue and, you know, talking, you know, pulling brains out of bodies and stuff, the wraparound stuff, is just silly and doesn't really, it's just a nothing kind of,
Yeah,
it's not, I mean, it's worth checking out to revisit it, but it's not, you know, nothing more than a curio.
Yeah, I remember thinking it was okay when it came out, but I don't know if Carpenter's ever going to direct another film. I do know that not long ago, they keep talking about doing an Escape from New York remake, and, you know, I don't remember the context, so don't quote me on this, but there was some sort of point at one point where, you know, somebody said, whoever's attached to it said, oh, we're going to do it out of love. And Carpenter, in typical cranky old man fashion, which I adored, said, it's not love, it's just money. You know, like, they want to remake Big Trouble in Little China, they want to remake all these things, and he's kind of like giving the middle finger to all of it. I think he actually was very fond of the recent Halloween film.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah. And I'm just trying to think. There's an actor that shows up only in his films, because he does use the same people a lot. You know, not only Pleasance, although he only used Pleasance twice.
Used Pleasance in isn't he the president in Escape from New York?
Yes, he is.
Okay, so he's in that, he's in Halloween, and he's in Prince of Darkness, right? Those three?
I believe so, yeah. No, I don't think he's in Prince of Darkness. Is he? No, I gotta look. He is. You're absolutely right. Yes, it's three.
He's the guy who brings the money in John Carpenter's Vampires. He has a bag of cash, which is why there's this dollar sign in the name, the title of the movie. That's what it is.
He likes to use actors like George Buck Flower, but there's one guy, and he's only like famous because he's in a few Carpenter films for me, and that his name is, I'm just trying to get it here. Is this him? Peter Jason? Yeah, Peter Jason. He was on Deadwood, and if you saw him, you'd go, oh yeah, okay, I recognize that guy.
But I recognize the name.
Yeah,
he's the guy. Whatever happened to the guy who was the lead in Precinct 13? That dude.
Austin, I don't know.
Pendleton.
He's still Austin Pendleton, not Austin Stoker. Austin Stoker's a different guy.
What happened to him? Did he ever do more stuff? Or
Austin? No, it is Austin Stoker. Well, he's still alive. He was just in a film called Three from Hell. Oh, a Rob Zombie film.
There you go. He's great.
He's really great. He's got a great presence.
What does Carpenter think of the Rob Zombie stuff?
I don't think that went. I think, as I recall, and I didn't. I hate the Rob Zombie. I hate the idea of them. And I guess Rob Zombie himself has said he's not really. Maybe he shouldn't have done it, but.
I seem to think that
John Carpenter kind of and him had a bit of a row. And Carpenter, you'd have to look up Carpenter Zombie, but you know, I think Rob Zombie said some things or quoted Carpenter, and Carpenter was like, I never said that, you know. I seem to recall that they were not getting on. And maybe they've patched things up, but yeah, nobody ever really talks about those zombie Halloweens.
I think they have their defenders, but I got nothing against Rob Zombie. I don't you know, wish he would go away or whatever.
No, I love his music.
I just think, you know, to me, the whole grimy, we're going to make this feel just like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, even more uncomfortable or more gross. That a little bit of that goes a long way. That for a while to me, that's like listening to a band where like every song sounds the same. And I feel like he's got this one sort of niche area that I think he does okay. I mean, the whole idea is like the actors aren't supposed to really be actors, you know, like just let them do their thing. Like,
yeah, it's not for me. But he does have his defenders and people who like his stuff, and
he
that's
made,
fine.
He made another one.
Yeah,
he made just, a new one.
Yeah,
like,
I think
people
Three
must
from
love
Hell.
This stuff.
I'm just really. I watched the House of a Thousand Corpses. I knew what he was trying to do, you know, that faux grindhouse thing, and I don't think it's something that you can just fake like that. Like, I don't personally think you can just, you know, put a bunch of filters on something. And those films kind of came out.
I agree.
Naturally, they, you know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. That creepiness is something that was like lightning in a bottle. They made that atmosphere.
Yep.
You know, it was 1,000 degrees in that house, and you know, like, it's just one of those things that, you know, you can make. A studio can't make an Evil Dead movie. They can, but it's not quite the same. You know.
Did you ever see that? Well, first off, that's a perfect summing up what you said.
Yeah.
You can't fake it. You know. You can't fake texture like that, like whatever that vibe is. But did you ever see the Evil Dead remake with the female lead, whose name I forgot, the actress?
No, I didn't. I saw a bit of it, and I really don't have any interest. I didn't hate that it was made, but I just
I had no interest in it, and I thought I'll see it. It was as such things go, it was quite good, and it takes the gore even further. I mean, it's very, very, very over the top, you know, gory, but there's an unsettling, I wouldn't run to it to put it on like, well, it's in the same family as the other Evil Dead. It's just that as such things go, when you're looking at things like Halloween or, you know, remakes of whatever, it's a worthy remake. I think they're trying something a little different. They take a female lead. You know, she's a drug addict. They're trying to take to this cabin to get her to dry out. And then, you know, shit kicks off, which is a fun layer to it. And it's very, very, very dark and gory and funny at times. But, it's an interesting thing to see. So he tours with the kid. He made an album.
Yeah.
I got at the show. I got his greatest hits sort of thing where they each track is a newly recorded version of the original title track or track from the movie or action sequence or whatever. He clearly must be just sitting back picking up paychecks with
royalties and that sort of thing. Yeah, I imagine life is good. I'm
the
a
new
huge
Halloween
fan. I still have a lot of respect for the man. I like a lot of his later career stuff, and if he ever directed something, I'd be at the theater to see it.
Hands down. He should not. I don't look at any of his stuff and go, oh, yeah, yeah, you know, not remotely. And to be fair, and I would say this about so many people that I dig or love, like you know, if Scorsese had never made another movie after Raging Bull. Or whatever, maybe after Goodfellas or whatever. The reputation is cemented. If Coppola had never done anything after 1980, the reputation is cemented. You can't take away from the body of work. And when you look at Carpenter, even though, you know, I mean, and again, this is a guy, too, that, like, he locks horns with studio people and, you know, whatever. So imagine him trying to get into the world. I think half the reason of what I saw in one interview about, like, why don't you do stuff now? He's like, are you kidding me? You know, 17 people to decide to move a piece of paper every time you open your mouth. Like, forget it. I'm too old. It's a waste of time. Da, 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 da. You look at the body of work, and I would say, really, I mean, even something like Christine that I have no interest in, from Assault on Precinct 13 up to at least In the Mouth of Madness.
Yeah.
That is a hell of a body of work.
Oh, I think so too. Yeah.
Don't you think?
I'm a huge proponent. I think he did some absolutely wonderful things, and yeah, it's a career to be proud of. And you know, even if he dared to come out against Marvel movies, I'd still love him.
This whole thing is just such a
stupid.
It's so stupid. It's such a dumb. Just something for the Twitter or the internet to jump on and go, you know. Well, you know, Mike
identify with the Avengers, you know, like, you know, these guys are saying you can't have a dessert, you can't have an all dessert buffet. You should have some vegetables in there.
Yes.
And people are like, yes. Shut up, Scorsese.
How did I hit all your stuff? What do you know? I mean, some of it, there is a part of me that hears it or reads it and thinks, well, that's a shame, because what that tells me is that no matter who you are, no matter what you do, no matter what you've achieved, apparently it is true that everybody at some point turns into their dad or their grandfather or whatever.
Yeah, that is the disappointment. Because
those were the old guys in the studio that hated these young bucks coming in, changing everything, telling them they were out of touch and they didn't know what they were doing and so on and so forth, making these pictures, these new kind of newfangled, you know, pictures with violence and stuff. You know, they're now sounding out of touch like those guys.
They're sounding like, yeah, but on the other hand, Grandpa Simpson.
I also don't think they're saying the MCU is a big pile of shit.
I don't think they are either. I think they're just saying, you know, basically, like, why is this the only thing you can go see? You know? And
well, to me it's more of a comment on the cost of tickets, getting a family out or whoever out to see a movie, how movies get swallowed up, and the way people are ingesting more movies. You're going to pay $18 to go out and see Endgame the weekend it comes out because you're getting 3 hours worth of spectacle and you're 80 bucks. But if it's, you know, the indie, you know, Tammy Gets a Nose Job, you know, with Jodie Foster as the mother, you know, with a scared child that's about to go plastic surgery that costs $12 to make.
Yeah.
You're probably going to watch that streaming in a couple of months. You're not going to run. So it's to me that they seem angry that, you know, the exposure is what they're probably angry at, which is, again, possibly, why Scorsese is doing Netflix. Why, how this, he couldn't do this without Netflix, this new movie, which is going to be a front runner for the friggin' Oscars.
Yeah.
He could not have done without Netflix.
Yeah, and that is a shame. And like I said, I'm just rolling my eyes at this whole thing. The outrage makes me laugh, you know, like, so what? They don't like it. That's fine, you know.
You know what? No one, someone as prominent as Robert Downey Jr. was interviewed by Howard Stern, and Stern, of course, pushed the buttons and brought it up. And Downey Jr. said, who cares? Because he goes, do you really think Martin Scorsese cares what I think about what he thinks about Marvel movies? Or like what they're entitled. Like, they're geniuses. They're entitled to not like this stuff. It's okay. Like, you know, and he gave his opinion on where he thought some of it might have been coming from, but he wasn't like, oh, F those guys.
Yeah.
They're pissing on legacy or something. They're, you know, we wouldn't have so much of cinema the way it is if not for these for these people.
Yeah, yeah.
Except for Mike Lee. I don't think Mike Lee has a right to fucking complain. Sorry. Mike Lee, like, British independent, you know, Mike Lee, love him. Mike Lee makes those little British movies that, like, have no script. All the actors sort of improvise everything, and he comes out and goes, I don't like the Marvel films either.
You know what the difference between Mike Lee and Scorsese and Coppola is? Most people didn't Google him after they read the quote. Or didn't Google the other two. You know, they knew who he was. I didn't know who Mike Lee was. But,
and I
want to
say that in all defense of Mike Lee, and I love a lot of his stuff. It's wonderful stuff. But it's funny that, like, Coppola, it's Scorsese, Coppola, da da da, and all of a sudden the background, I'd like to say something too about what I think about Marvel movies. What? Who's in the back of the room?
We also haven't heard what John Boorman thinks.
Right. We need to hear from him. And the guy who directed Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan, Lord of the Jungle.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. But, all right, folks. Well, happy Halloween. I hope you've liked our take on John Carpenter. And thank you again for listening. I hope you'll join us in our Pod Stallions Facebook group. We can talk more Carpenter.
Thank you, everybody. We wanted to, just FYI, we wanted to do two Halloween episodes that we always do every year. Life has intervened in certain ways. Good and bad. Nothing tragic or anything, but just good and bad. So we really apologize that it's
taken
so long.
Well, we got one and a half in.
We got one and a half.
Yeah.
And we're thinking of Halloween all year long.
Yeah.
So
we'll do another horror related one in November, and we'll get on it real soon.
And then we'll do our Mike Lee episode before the end of the year.
Oh, absolutely! But I have to go watch everything he's directed.
All right.
All right. Take care, everybody. Happy Halloween.
Take care.